Afraid you've lost your audience?
No longer a law student. May it please the court, my name is Lee Crawford Boyd. I represent the appellants Gargi and Gayatri DeVay. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Members of the court, the judicial immunity provision of the Libyan Claims Resolution Act bars the enforcement of the arbitration clause in this joint prosecution agreement because the only rights to be enforced are by foreign nationals under the contract, and they are based solely on the prosecution of those foreign nationals' legal claims against Libya, which are the very same claims that were diplomatically settled and espoused by the political branches in 2008 and provided their under their own terms provided by the political branches, that the recovery, which in this case is indisputably the Libyan Settlement Fund money that was established under the Claim Settlement Agreement, would be solely for United States nationals, American victims of Libyan terrorism, at an amount considered fair compensation, as that term is defined and adjudicated by the executive branch. In short, on statutory interpretation grounds and on constitutional separation of powers grounds, this property, the Libyan Settlement Fund, which is at stake in the claims being sent to arbitration, has to be held sacrosanct by the judicial branch and is not subject to second guessing or claims brought under state contract law, which are in conflict. Accordingly, the district court's order compelling arbitration of these contract claims must be reversed. I would like to touch on 3 points in my short time. One is what I believe to be the pivotal error of reasoning at the district court decision, which is the mischaracterization of what this contract, which is attached to the arbitration demand, does. It was characterized as a mere sharing agreement, sharing the proceeds of the Libyan Settlement Fund once in the hands of the United States victims. It was not. It was a prosecution of legal claims, and any recovery was consideration for and conditioned on the prosecution of these foreign national plaintiffs' legal claims against Libya, the very claims espoused and settled.
By shares, right?
There was a formula under the contract, Judge Randolph, which was agreed among the parties.
There's a business that is gaining some momentum where companies will go out and buy the possibility of your recovery in a lawsuit and pay you a certain amount. You would say that would be illegal under your theory of this case, right?
No, Your Honor.
If your clients got... somebody paid them $1 million for their, because of the prospect that they might recover, and signed an agreement to that effect that the full recovery shall go to this corporation. Would that be prohibited?
No, it wouldn't, Judge. And that brings me to my first point, which is the source of the rights being enforced under this arbitration clause. The source in your hypothetical is not based on the prosecution of legal claims for terrorism injury against Libya. And one of the things I'd like to direct the court's attention to is the record wherein the joint prosecution agreement is appended to the arbitration demand. And the scope of that and the terms of that agreement evidence that the source of the rights are the legal claims against Libya brought by these foreign nationals, the very same claims espoused. I quote from the contract, the parties enter into this agreement to jointly pursue their legal claims in the same proceedings.
What page is it?
I'm on page of the record 13 and 14. I'm sorry, 12 and 13.
That's not the joint appendix. That's page 43. Is that 42, 43? Is that right?
Oh, yes, sir, yes, sir. I was in the arbitration demand, so we're at 32 and 33 is the JPA contract.
That's where it starts.
Starts there, and I'm quoting from page 33. The parties enter in the agreement to jointly pursue their legal claims, and that's a
preamble.
Conjunctive. Yes, Your Honor, but it's indisputed in this case, and as the arbitration demand, which I was quoting from, proposed in their motion to compel, that the prosecution agreement in this case was not a sharing agreement only. It was a prosecution agreement, and the only recovery enforced and it's sought under these contract claims is a portion of the Libyan settlement fund in return for a prosecution of the legal claims settled by the political branches, by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the executive with the sovereign Libya. Not only is the source of rights the legal claims, but the maturation or the maturing of those rights did not occur when the money reached the hands of the U.S. citizens, the Americans. It matured in 2008 at the establishment of the Libyan Settlement Fund pursuant to the claims settlement agreement.
The argument, I think I understand it now, I didn't before, but your argument on the merits is that this is not a recovery resulting from the legal proceedings. Is that your argument?
Well, Your Honor, the merits were not before the district court. The merits,
right.
The merits are the interpretation of the contract. I'm taking as a given and assumed.
Why isn't that for the arbitrator to decide?
Yes, Your Honor, the question on the merits is for the arbitrator. What is for this court and the court below, and Judge Bates took it as such, was whether or not the Libyan settlement, the Libyan Claims Resolution Act judicial immunity provision precluded the enforcement under the FAA, under the immunity provision.
The immunity is only, I think we need to look at the text of the statute in order to get anywhere with this. The immunity is not immunity from suit by one person against another. It's an immunity for property, right?
Property. Yes.
That's all. It says any property described in subparagraph B of this paragraph shall be immune from attachment or any other judicial process, right?
Correct. The property.
The suit here is not against the property. The suit here is in personam. So why is this? I'm not following exactly why the statute is relevant at all today.
Well, Your Honor, the intent of Congress behind this statute, as stated.
Let's start with the words.
The
words are
property.
Property, and then it uses the usual kind of reference to property, namely attachment. So if we look only at the words, you lose. Is that right?
No, Your Honor, because the words also say any judicial process, and these are claims brought against the Libyan Settlement Fund as a recovery for prosecution.
Are they
of
claims,
legal claims
brought against the fund, or are they claims brought against your individual clients as human beings?
Well, Your Honor, the statute.
The Supreme Court just pointed out there was a difference between persons and corporations for purposes of different statutes.
There is a difference between in personam and in rem, but
right.
There's no indication in the words of this statute, particularly I'm talking about the all other judicial process, would preclude.
It says it's the property that shall be immune from any other judicial process. It's not your clients who are immune from any other process.
But the intent of the statute, Your Honor, is that property reach the clients intact.
Now we're on intent. Now we're not on the words of the statute.
No, right? Your Honor, I'll go back to the words. All other judicial process is inclusive of not only in rem, but in personam. That is from the Supreme Court cases that we cited in this court, in which similar language, all other judicial process, was interpreted to include broader range of judicial remedies.
Do those statutes that you're talking about have the introductory phrase, any property shall be immune from judicial process?
Actually, in Dames and Moore, property was immune from judgment, attachment, and all other judicial process. And in that case, which reminds me very much of this case, although it's many years ago, where there was property that the Congress intended to keep sacrosanct in order to use it or for their own motives in a political settlement.
Have your clients received the $3 million?
Some have, some have not. They are being processed by the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission, these claims, and because there is not a quorum of commissioners at this time, the settlement funds have been in a moratorium.
Who do you represent?
I represent eight of the U.S. American victims in this appeal. I represented two at the motion to compel, although all have joined into
but
the arbitration.
But the two you represent have received the money, haven't
No,
they?
Sir. One has. One has not.
Oh, okay.
Going to the words and the interpretation of the LCRA, because I think I've touched on what the argument was and the mischaracterization at below on the contract being one for legal claims, not for a mere sharing. Therefore, the hypothetical by Judge Randolph would not be covered under the LCRA. I will turn to the interpretation of the LCRA.
Let's suppose, just deal with the client that received the money, okay? And suppose that individual is independently wealthy, has $10 million in cash, right? And an arbitrator or a judge orders that individual, because of the contract that they entered into, to pony up $500,000, right? How does that violate the statute?
Well, Your Honor, if ponying up includes someone receiving recovery that was not intended under the political branch's settlement for terrorism injuries from the terrorism fund, then it would violate the statute.
Well, they already got the, you know, your client got the money. Money's fungible. And your client may say, well, you know, I've got my $3 million. You can't touch that. The arbitrator says, well, you know, draw $500,000 out of that other bank account then, if that's your theory.
It's not our theory.
It doesn't make much sense to me.
That is not our theory, Your Honor. The theory is not that they don't have obligations that are previous, that they owe debts to, nor is it that that money can never be used, as the district court said, in perpetuity to pay their debts, nor are they precluded from sharing this money. What is precluded in this particular case is on these terms of this contract, which was not considered by the district court, that the enforcement of the contract by necessity only is for recovery from the portion of the Libyan settlement fund in consideration of a prosecution of legal claims against Libya. And those legal claims.
You can't get that out of the act, the words of the act that we're talking about now, can you? That limitation, which is that they can be sued for their dry cleaning but can't be sued with respect to the Libyan claims, that doesn't come out of the act.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that it does come out of the act because the act is interpreted by...
Which words in the act? I'm not against you interpreting from things outside, but I first want to know that you're doing that. Which words in the act allow you to distinguish between a subsequent lawsuit for payment for dry cleaning, where the money comes out of the money that your client gets from the claims, and these people's suit?
The exact words are in subsection B, mm-hmm. little 1. Mm-hmm. Property is described as that relates to the claims agreement. Yes. And subsection 2, and for the purpose of implementing the claims agreement. So the property that relates to the claims agreement is recovery from Libya for terrorism injuries. It is not property
That describes the property, but if the dry cleaner sues and gets that money, he's also getting money that relates to the claims agreement.
Well, I would argue that he's not, because he doesn't make a claim for a portion of the Libyan settlement fund per se as a recovery for claims brought. And remember, the only claims brought here were for Libyan terrorism injury. And those claims by foreign nationals were precluded by the political branches in their own wisdom. At their own motives, they chose not to allow foreign nationals to recover a portion of the claims-related property, as defined here, to foreclose any suits in the United States courts. And I would argue that this fits under a claim against the Libyan settlement fund for a portion of it to compensate, and only to compensate, terrorism injuries under a different formula by private contract. And it is without dispute in the Supreme Court precedent regarding claim settlement agreements that no contract claims, whether they are valid absent political diplomatic settlement, no claims can be enforced when there are competing terms for those very claims during the espousal and settlement by the political branches with congressional acquiescence. And I submit that the constitutional principles underlying this immunity provision were well understood by Congress, which is why they included such absolute language as the non obstante clause, which was not considered.
I would have thought you'd answer Judge Garland's question a little bit differently. Rather than, I understand your answer under sub little I, but under little I and then capital I3, the property is property that's been transferred from the entity.
Yes, Your Honor, and that it brings me to
your client that's received the $3 million, that's property that was transferred from the entity, wasn't it?
By the plain language of the statute, there is no time limit written in to the plain words. The immunity stands whether it's before the money's transferred to the entity, held by the entity, or leaves the entity. Here, we have no dispute that it's
that
the Department of Treasury.
That's what Judge Bates said leads to the conclusion that you have an immunized pot of money that can never be touched by the dry cleaner or anyone else.
And I believe that that error of reasoning and error of law came from a mischaracterization of what this contract does.
Comes from an interpretation of the meaning of the statute. It doesn't really have anything to do with your contract.
Well, Judge, I would argue that it does have something to do with the contract, because I don't think Judge Bates disagreed that the immunity would cover claims brought by foreign nationals for a piece of the pot that was established by Libya at the during the diplomacy and political settlement by the political branches. What he had a problem with, it seems to me from his decision and at the time, was the fact that this was a mere sharing agreement, and that is stated over and over and has been picked up, of course, by the liaison group. And it is not a mere sharing agreement. That would not cover. It is a joint prosecution agreement, ergo the name. It's a prosecution of claims, and that prosecution was in consideration for a sharing in the recovery. And the recovery matured, and these claims matured at the point Libya satisfied their debt to the United States and put that money in the humanitarian fund. And that is the money that is the subject of these claims. And that is why I believe that this statute, and we submit, does extend to this unique case, which is not every case brought by a dry cleaner or a MasterCard or some investor. It is a claim brought by foreign nationals who the political branches made very clear were precluded and could not bring claims in U.S. courts. And the judicial immunity is broadly written with a non obstante clause not considered by the district court, with a broad language of judicial process, which has been held to cover a broad range of remedies. I see I'm far over my time, and I do want to reserve a moment. Because the constitutional principles militate in favor of the DeVay's interpretation of this statute, the district court should be reversed, and appreciate your time. Thank you.
We'll hear from the other side.
Good morning, Your Honors. Judge Garland, and may it please the court. The district court was correct to compel arbitration for two principal and independent reasons. The first was the one, Judge Garland, you raised in your questioning of counsel, and that is that the statutory immunity on which the DaVays rely to seek to overturn the order to compel extends to property, not persons. And related to that is that this arbitration...
Isn't exactly the ground upon which the district court relied, though. He didn't actually focus on the word property.
It was not the sole focus of the district court opinion. The district court opinion determined that the scope of the immunity did not extend to these private contract claims because they are brought to enforce rights and duties under a contract in personam. Among other things, they are not directed at property, so that's a ground on which it could be upheld, and it's independently sufficient. In fact, I think counsel essentially acknowledged that it's independently sufficient because the arbitration, although she attempted to suggest otherwise, the arbitration concerns rights and duties under a private contract. It doesn't seek a recovery from the fund. It doesn't.
So in other words, if one of these individuals, hypothetically, the only assets that individual has are the $3 million that were deposited in a separate segregated fund, and that's all they have, they go through arbitration. Are you suggesting that that a court order enforcing the arbitration award couldn't touch the $3 million?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. I am suggesting two things. First, at this stage, the immunity of property is dispositive of the motion to compel. Beyond that, their argument that the award remains immune after the transfer is based on an interpretation of the text of the statute that is unavailable to them because it is nonsensical. The words
say that. You know, we talk about plain meaning, and it says property transferred from the entity.
Your Honor,
the plain meaning argument is one that is against your position.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
In favor of the claimants.
I don't think so, Your Honor, for this reason. First, the phrase in its entirety is transferred from, right, which admittedly is subject to two interpretations. It either defines an event or a period or activity, or it means forever after. The second alternative is the interpretation that Aves offered first, and it's unavailable because it's a lot.
I don't see the two. If this is property that's transferred from the entity. The property, first of all, the money has to have been transferred to the individual, because wasn't there a lawsuit where it was an attempt to put all this money in a separate segregated fund and then parcel it out according to the joint prosecution agreement, and that was rejected?
Not quite, Your Honor. I know what you're referring to, and the answer is that many of the awardees voluntarily contributed their funds to the common fund. So to that extent, that's the way in which you're right, but it's an important distinction.
Under this statute, the money, you couldn't stop the money from going to one of the United States nationals. They've got to get the money, and under your theory, then the agreement forces them to pay it back.
Almost exactly correct, Your Honor. Certainly correct about the first part, which is that under the statute, we can't intercept the funds. That's what is transferred from means. That's the practical result it seeks to achieve. What we then are entitled to do is enforce the in personam rights under the sharing agreement by requiring them in one form or another to pay amounts or to satisfy contract obligations to share. And that can be...
Mr. Shapiro, may I interrupt you? I don't think that the transferred from has any bearing on the question whether you could intercept the funds before they're paid out. It's the first two clauses that prevent that. It's money held by an entity or transferred to the entity. It's the transferred from, it deals with something entirely different. It's after it's been paid.
Well, what it deals with is the obligations the United States assumed under the claim settlement agreement, which are in terms, that's the promise that Libya insisted upon and received as a condition of the claim settlement agreement. Mm. And that language in Article 4 of the claim settlement agreement refers to taking steps. The United States has to take steps to ensure that no attachment or other judicial process interferes with the flow of funds into the entity, held by the entity, or being transferred from the entity. And I believe the statutory language, the statutory language tracks the obligation under the claim settlement agreement. The purpose of the statutory language is to assure Libya, which hadn't yet signed the treaty, that the United States would comply with the obligations that Libya wanted. Whether metaphysically there's no such time as a period in which the funds are being transferred and not held by the entity is an interesting question, but Libya decided that question for the United States by obtaining in the statute a promise to enact implementing legislation that would have that effect. The statute does that. It would prevent any argument about what the status of the funds is, for example, when the check has been issued but hasn't been deposited or the like. It does prevent the blocking or intercept. And to get back to your original question, Your Honor, the Claims Resolution Act does prevent that kind of block or intercept or freeze, which is what governments that are negotiating an agreement would logically worry about. What they wouldn't logically worry about is how the awardees decide, through obligations they assume either before or after they receive their awards, to dispose of those awards in purely private activity. And counsel essentially conceded that in response to your question during her argument, when she agreed that investors are free to invest in litigation, or at least nothing in the Libyan Claims Resolution Act would block them from so doing. It seems possible to me to conceive of these parties to the joint prosecution agreement as exactly that, co-investors in a common effort to obtain compensation from Libya with arrangements through shares to allocate those funds among themselves after any recovery is received. All of that is an obligation that they take on under a contract. The terms and satisfaction of those contract obligations is obviously not at stake on the motion to compel. But there's nothing
what
in the statute.
Your understanding of what exactly is the subject of the arbitration that's been ordered? What is there to arbitrate?
Your Honor, I would say the subject of the arbitration is what the rights and duties of the parties are under the JPA and whether or not they have performed those duties. There, obviously, that's one sentence about an arbitration whose result will presumably be expressed in more than one sentence, and there'll be more than one sentence spoken by the sides.
Is it up to the arbitrator to adjudicate whether this provision supersedes the contract? Would the arbitrator have that authority?
You know, ordinarily, questions of substantive law are referred to the arbitrator, but because of the way this came up and because of the argument that the Daves made to try to defeat the motion to compel, I think there's at least an aspect of it that is for resolution by the court, and here's how I get there. The court has to decide arbitrability. What the Daves argued below, and effectively argue here, is that the court lacked authority to order arbitration based on the statutory immunity. Therefore, in order to decide arbitrability, the court has to take the threshold step of determining whether the statutory immunity disables the court from considering the question committed to it, namely whether arbitration ought to be ordered.
I keep thinking of this Renicar case. That essentially, the argument is that the entire joint prosecution agreement is void as a consequence of this statute. And in that circumstance, the way I read Renicar is that's not an attack just on the arbitration clause. It's an attack on the entire validity of the contract, and therefore that's for the arbitrator to decide, not the court.
The threshold, I believe there may be aspects of the question that are for the arbitrator to decide. I don't dispute that, but I think there's at least a slice, and I think as a practical matter, the determination of that slice is likely to be dispositive. There is at least a slice that I think the court below determined it had to reach, and I think it was correct, because of the argument about why arbitration could not be ordered, because of the way that argument was made by the Daves. When they argue to the court that it can't decide arbitrability because the statute takes that away from the court, it seems to me the court has to resolve that at the threshold, and that in order to resolve that, the court has to decide the scope of statutory immunity, at least to that extent. That whether that leaves residual aspects of of the impact of the statute for the arbitrator is a different matter.
Okay, I just wonder about this point. Neither of you thought it necessary to include the discussion of Renicar in the text of your briefs. This is only mentioned in the footnotes of the brief and then I guess in a footnote of the district court. Is this an argument that's basically been waived? I mean, under our rules, if you can't do any better than putting it in a footnote, both of you doing the same, appears that both of you have agreed for this decision to be, whether or not this is really an attack on the arbitration clause or an attack on the entire contract, it's sort of before us. Is that wrong?
I don't. Certainly, we didn't mean to waive it, Your Honor. That's why we put it in the footnote. I suppose we engaged
in. It seems like you said that for purposes of preserving the argument, and then you have it in the middle of a footnote. This usually is not sufficient to preserve an argument from our point of view.
I understand, Your Honor.
You must know that, and if it really mattered, you would have put it in the text.
Here's why we did it, Your Honor. We believe the district court was correct to conclude that it had the authority and, in fact, probably the responsibility, at least to a significant extent, to determine the scope of statutory immunity, and that as a practical matter, that determination is binding on, because it is binding on the parties, is going to end up being dispositive of the scope of statutory immunity for the case as a whole.
If we were to say that rent-a-car applies here and that this is really an attack on the contract and not an attack on the arbitration clause, then we would vacate the district court's opinion and send it to the arbitrator, and you'd be making all these arguments all over again. I thought the reason you let it go was you thought maybe you were going to be lucky and you had a winner, and you didn't want to have this all re-argued again. Am I wrong about the strategy here?
Lucky, Your Honor. No, we merit.
Well, lucky. I mean, it's a little bit
better
like
to be good than, better to be good than
it's
lucky.
It's like Clint Eastwood asking, do you feel lucky today?
Are we at the beginning of the movie or the end?
Good point. I mean, the consequence if we took the rent-a-car argument to the end would be you would win, but you wouldn't win on the ground of the district court. You would simply win on the ground that this is an attack on the contract, and the whole thing has to go to the arbitrator.
I don't know what's. That's why I asked this conversation to start. If you accept Judge Bates's opinion, and assuming hypothetically we agreed with it, I don't know what there's left to arbitrate
on the question of the statute.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I think that's correct, and I also, I think it disposes of the statutory immunity, and that really is what I meant to say in response to the prior question, that regardless how much of the statutory immunity argument has to be resolved by the court, I believe there's a sufficient component that the court must resolve because of the way it was presented, that as a practical matter, it makes no difference, and I suppose that is why we relegated I certainly can't tell you that we relegated the argument about reserving something for the arbitrator to a fallback status. I think it's because we believe that if there's something left for the arbitrator, it's either a partial narrow slice or something that is so foreordained by the opinion of the court that it makes little difference.
There'd still be the question before the arbitrator about whether this, maybe not as a matter of some preclusive immunity, but as a matter of superseding the contract, applies.
I assume the other side
would be arguing that, we're no longer really dividing this up as a result of some prosecution that the joint group brought. We're dividing this up based on an agreement between two governments. That's the way it is, and the contract's now sort of out of the picture.
Your Honor, if I correctly understand the way you just described that hypothetical, that would be a question of the merits of the contract and the extent
right.
of its coverage. And I don't think that
would be something arbitrary.
I don't have an argument that that's for resolution by the court.
The statute, the case can be resolved simply by saying that the arbitration requirement is not a requirement or is not against property; it's against the individual. And even after the arbitrator issued an award or refused to issue an award, suppose the arbitrator issued an award, that would not be covered by the statute either, unless you said an arbitrator is part of the judicial process, which it's not. The issue that Judge Bates decided then would arise only at the point where a court would enforce the arbiter.
Or particularly if you try to attach something.
Yeah.
Which we believe is not before the court on the motion to compel, and I guess, given the, if I understand the hypothetical correctly, wouldn't be before the arbitrator in the arbitration.
Yeah.
Which is why the Claims Resolution Act doesn't preclude the motion to compel, doesn't provide any basis for reversal of the order below.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Borden, you wanted to reserve a moment, and you have one. We'll leave the interpretation of the length of the moment to you.
Thank you.
With appropriate limitations.
Broad interpretation. just a couple of points. One is what Judge Bates decided and what's before the arbitrator. The question of arbitrability was discussed during, it's in the transcript, was discussed during the oral argument, that Judge Bates was deciding the question of arbitrability, which I interpret in before this court as whether or not the FAA can exist, coexist, in this case, with the LCRA immunity provision. And we argue that all other judicial process includes this case because the claims settlement agreement established a Libyan settlement fund. And at the point of that, the liaison group, and it's in the record, enforced and the rights under the JPA for the foreign nationals, and they at that point had a right
Your
under this contract.
Though, I look for an argument on your behalf that is restricted solely to the question of arbitrability. I don't see it. Your argument it really goes to the validity of the joint prosecution agreement itself. That once the statute comes into effect, that agreement is void. And in that situation, I just don't understand why Rent-A-Car doesn't just require an order to arbitrate. And your arguments that you made in the district court and that are being made here for the arbitrator.
Oh, well, Your Honor, 2 points to that. One is I will inform the court that the arbitrators one of their first orders was to request briefing on the issue of how the LCRA is a defense to the contract as a whole, and also asked briefing on whether that was decided by Judge Bates. And on a very rare moment, I believe that we were, my opponent and I were in agreement that the arbitrability, while there is substantial overlap and bleeding into the issue, was before Judge Bates, not the merits of the defense to contract that was requested by the court, by the arbitrator. We went through the hearing before the arbitration, and the question was fully argued, and an order from the arbitrator has stated that they are waiting for the decision of this court in order to decide the question before the arbitration. So, I just wanted to inform the court of that, and also that the question of arbitrability here is the question of the enforcement of the FAA in this case in light of the judicial immunity. And one other point before I sit down.
Is there any other issue that the arbitrators are considering aside from the impact of the statute on the agreement?
Yes, they will be, of course, on the merits. This was a preliminary hearing order on the preliminary hearing. They will, of course, if depending on how they determine the preliminary question, which we believe would be a summary judgment type question as a matter of law, they would move to the merits on the interpretation. And of course, there is that is greatly in dispute whether or not this money that was provided by the political branches for fair compensation to U.S. nationals can be attacked by contract. That is, of course, in dispute on the merits. And as I said, we were in agreement that the question before Judge Bates and
I just want to be, not that it's in play here, but is the argument that before the arbitrator, the joint prosecution agreement doesn't apply because this is not money that has resulted from a judicial proceeding, it's an act of Congress instead? Is that the argument?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
No, okay.
Yes, Judge. One final point before I sit down is the intent of Congress that is also relevant to statutory interpretation. And it's very well stated, very clearly stated in Section 3, that the point of this settlement was not only normalizing relations with Libya, but to provide fair compensation for the victims of U.S. terrorism. That was preeminent in that administration's mind. This suit directly brought under the arbitration clause is to attack that fair compensation at the point the Libyan Settlement Fund was established. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under submission.